Okay, so this talk is intended, I think, to be a broad overview of the theory of clarions. And so I would like to describe for you three different aspects of the subject area. The first is the evolution of clarions as a spatially integrated blob. So you just treat it as a blob. How does its luminosity change? How does its magnetic field spectrum, etc., change? Secondly, what is the internal structure of this blob? And finally, how can we use clarions as a calorimeter that allows you to then probe the pulsar wind which drives the clarion itself? And I will just remind you that that pulsar wind is basically otherwise invisible. Okay, firstly though, let me remind you briefly what a clarion is. It is a supernova remnant that looks like the crab. This is the ITP, so with an emphasis on the T, so we'll go with that for the moment. It has a center-filled morphology with or without a shell of ejecta, non-thermal spectrum with a break in it, so about -0.3, say in the radio, -0.8 to -1 in the X-ray, typical numbers, and very high linear polarization. I have a picture of clarion G327.1. Top panel is a radio map. You can see the contours here showing the shell of ejecta, and then the central blob is the center-filled clarion. Enlarging this part of the diagram and going down here, we have the radio contours again, and then superimposed a messy little grayscale of the X-ray contours. So you can see that the radio and X-ray clarions are almost coincident, although not exactly. Now, the zeroth order description of what a clarion is: a synchrotron emitting bubble of magnetic field and relativistic electrons that have been injected, the magnetic field and electrons have been injected into the bubble by the pulsar, specifically the pulsar wind, and the bubble as a whole is confined by the shell of ejecta. Immediately we run into a theoretical puzzle here. Some clarions are seen to have a shell around them, others are not, and vice versa. It's not fully understood why that is, and I don't have time to go into it here. The evolution of the shell surface brightness depends on complicated things like turbulent amplification of magnetic field, etc. I invite you to look at the excellent article by Bhattacharya in 1990 on this subject. Okay, so the first part of the talk revolves around treating the clarion as a blob and asking how it evolves with time. It goes through roughly four stages in its life. The first, less than 100 years old, there is no clarion because the synchrotron emission is absorbed by, for example, free-free process. Phase two, 100 to 1,000 years old, the clarion illuminates and enters a stage of free expansion where the outer boundary of the clarion increases, its radius increases roughly proportional to time. This is the stage in which the crab finds itself. In this stage, the pulsar injects magnetic field and relativistic electrons with a power law energy spectrum. Notice that this is e to the minus a. I want you to remember that a for the next overhead. Power law energy spectrum into the bubble. The electrons degrade by adiabatic and synchrotron losses. And during this stage, the luminosity of the pulsar is roughly constant because the pulsar is still young, isn't spinning down very much. Between 1,000 and 10,000 years, the same thing happens, except now the pulsar luminosity falls away steeply with time because the pulsar is getting older and spinning down. The final stage occurs when this shell, which is happily going out as a set of blast wave, sweeps up enough of the surrounding material such that it stalls. This is the familiar snowplow effect. Okay? When it starts to stall, a shock wave, a reverse shock, is launched inwards from that shell and moves towards the clarion. Now that shock is going to squish the clarion, so the clarion will brighten momentarily, and then it will again start to re-expand, but more slowly, a bit more like this set of solution rather than the free expansion. should point out that that reverse shock is very often corrugated. It is exposed to Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities, and those corrugations can then impose themselves upon the Plerion. And people like Roger Chevalier have argued that the complicated structure of the Baylor X remnant comes from that kind of mechanism. Okay, now, the theory of this blob is mainly directed at describing the phase of free expansion. And when you do that, you want to monitor two things, the magnetic field and the energy of the electrons. The magnetic field energy increases because the pulsar is constantly putting magnetic flux into the Plerion, but it decreases because the Plerion is expanding and magnetic field lines are teased apart. When you calculate this, you find that the magnetic field decreases inversely with time in phase 2. Remember, phase 2 was the one where the pulsar luminosity is constant, the pulsar is young, so the pulsar is basically on. It goes down as t to the minus 2 in phase 3, where the pulsar is older, luminosity is lower, the pulsar is kind of off. And this corresponds to magnetic flux conservation. Okay, now the second thing to follow is the energy of the electrons in the bubble. They decrease, that energy decreases due to synchrotron losses, proportional to energy squared, due to adiabatic losses, linearly proportional to the energy. Now you can see that for high energy electrons, the synchrotron losses are much stronger than the adiabatic losses because of d squared. For low energy electrons, the opposite is true. The energy that divides those two regimes of synchrotron and adiabatic is called the break energy, and you can see from this easily that it scales as inverse magnetic field squared, inverse of time. Okay, now this following these energies is important because those energies, that evolution determines the evolution of the spectrum of the Plerion, which is something we observe. And that is the what these plots are meant to show here. Now, I want to start in the top corner by showing you what happens if the magnetic field in the Plerion is constant. Magnetic field in the Plerion is obviously not constant. We just showed that it decreases with time. But I want just to fix ideas. I want to show you what happens in the constant field case. So this is logarithm of the number of electrons at a particular energy as a function of energy. And you can see that this spectrum has a break in it. Down here, adiabatic losses were important. And the slope is the same as the minus A of the injection, of the electron injection spectrum. Below the break, the slope steepens to minus A minus 1. Okay, and this is where the synchrotron losses were important. The reason for this steepening is that the synchrotron losses are killing the electrons very fast, and those electrons are then pushed to lower and lower energy. And as time goes by, it's clear that this break frequency is going to move lower because as more time goes by, more and more of the high-energy electrons are degraded by synchrotron losses. Now, in an actual Plerion, the magnetic field is decreasing, so we have a slightly different behavior. During phase 2, when, remember, the pulsar is on, it's young, there is again a break with these slopes, but the break energy is increasing with time. The reason is that the magnetic field in the Plerion is decreasing, and so the synchrotron break time goes up. We then move to phase 3, where, remember, now the pulsar switches off. In phase 3, we still have a break at this upper end where the synchrotron and adiabatic balance, but a new second break also appears right here. And this new second break corresponds to the maximum energy of the electrons that were injected just in the previous phase, in phase 2. Okay, now those electrons were injected, their maximum energy is going down slowly due to adiabatic cooling, and so that introduces a new break in the spectrum here. And then finally, there is, again in phase 3, but later, one can get the situation where this break, synchrotron break frequency runs into the upper end of the electron energy spectrum. There are no more electrons for which synchrotron cooling is important then, and so a new break frequency appears, which also moves down. That's a little bit complicated, I won't go into it. The slopes here it's still minus A, but the slopes here are determined by how quickly the pulsar luminosity is decreasing with time. Okay, now let me also mention quickly that the total luminosity of this Pleiron decreases with time in this kind of blob model, and that has been verified by measurements of the crab, which show a decrease of 0.2% per year. There are lots of open questions in this blob model. The first is whether the spectral breaks that I just described to you are actually seen. Okay, one way they might be seen, for example, is a deficit in the infrared with respect to the extrapolation of the spectra that you would get from the radio and the X-ray. So I can just put this back up quickly to show you what I mean. If we extrapolate this one like this and this one like this, we'd expect to be up here, but this kind of model would predict a lower infrared flux. Well, there's related work on this subject, including a very nice poster by Bandiera et al. Down the back, which I encourage you to look at. Now, second open question is the existence of the many non-crab-like Pleirions, such as 3C58, CTB87. These guys are unusual because they have a break frequency which is low, less than 50 gigahertz. That implies an unnaturally, by some standards, large magnetic field within the Pleirion. They also have a difference in spectral indices above and below the break, radio minus X-ray, of 0.5, which is greater than the canonical value of 0.5. I should say, remember, we had an electron energy spectrum which was minus A and then minus A minus 1. That difference of 1 in electron energy slopes corresponds to a difference of 0.5 in the photon spectrum that you actually observe. In these guys, you get more than the canonical value of 0.5. And then finally, one finds that in many of these non-crab-like Pleirions, the total luminosity increases with time rather than decreasing, for example, 0.3% per year in 3C58. Third theoretical question, how to explain the X-ray luminosity versus spin-down luminosity scaling found by Seward et al. Using Einstein data and then later ASCA data. Chevalier this year has put out a paper trying to explain this with a single-zone Pleirion model. That explanation is moderately but not completely successful. And the final theoretical open question I wanted to mention concerns Pleirions around soft gamma ray repeaters. We're talking about SGRs a lot in this meeting. Many of them have, some of them have Pleirions around them, and those Pleirions have a radio spectrum which is steeper than usual, minus 0.6 instead of minus 0.3. It is a challenge to explain that steeper spectrum. The idea that is doing the rounds is that these Pleirions are not powered in a constant, sort of continuous way by a pulsar. They're powered instead in a bursty fashion. You deposit electrons and frozen in magnetic field in a bursty way into the Pleirion. That matches, of course, the bursty nature of the SGRs. If that is true, then the separation of the bursts, which is like a day, is much shorter than the synchrotron lifetime and the adiabatic time of the Pleirion. And so the emission from each burst by the Pleirion will blend together over time because of this inequality. Okay, remember, this is not the emission of the SGR. This is the emission from the Pleirion once the SGR dumped a whole bunch of material and magnetic field into it. Okay, and then the envelope of all of these different injection events should produce a steeper spectrum. Notice that a bright injection event also shifts down in frequency, because a bright injection event puts a lot of magnetic field into the Pleirion, and so the synchrotron break moves lower. Okay, so that concludes the description of Pleirions as a spatially integrated blob. I now want to turn to the question of what the Pleirion looks like in its interior. This picture shows the Pleirion, that's the dots. Inside it is the pulsar, and the pulsar is emitting a relativistic wind of particles into the Pleirion. That wind is supersonic, so the wind terminates in a shock. That shock occurs at the position where the ram pressure of the pulsar outflow is balanced by the total pressure in the nebula, due to the totally, like the time integrated energy input into the Pleiron over its lifetime. That gives a simple scaling which is actually surprisingly good at explaining observations. So that's point one, there is a shock. Point two is that I can show that if the pulsar wind is confined by the Pleiron in this way, then the flow must be dominated by kinetic energy, not magnetic energy, at the termination shock. Now you may wonder, why am I talking about this? It's not very interesting, but the point is that, as you'll see later on, this question of whether the pulsar wind is kinetic dominated or magnetic dominated is actually an open question and a very important one. But we'll leave that aside for the moment. How do I know that it must be kinetic dominated? Well, if it's confined in this way, then I need to decelerate the flow from like one third of the speed of light at the shock to 1,500 kilometers per second, which is the expansion velocity of the outer edge of the Pleiron, as obtained from like Doppler shift of spectral lines in the line emitting filaments of the crab. In order to do that, so I need to decelerate the flow. Now, the plasma in here is a very good conductor, and that means that the magnetic field in the plasma is frozen into the fluid. Okay, so as it moves along, the magnetic field, as the fluid moves along, the magnetic field flows with it. If you slow down the flow, that obviously means that the magnetic field is going to pile up, okay, just as the fluid is slowing down. And it's clear that you cannot pile up the magnetic field if the flow was magnetic energy dominated. Because if it was magnetic energy dominated, the magnetic field would rebel. It would just say, no, I don't want to be piled up. The magnetic pressure, the magnetic tension would push the flow outwards and pile up wouldn't happen. And if pile up didn't happen, then you wouldn't be able to smoothly go from a relativistic, like C on 3, to 1,500 kilometers per second at the edge. So this argument shows that here, the magnetic energy must be low compared to the kinetic energy. And what can be more quantitative about that? Here is again the wind, the pulsar wind, the Pleiron. Here is the shock between the two, 0.1 parsecs for the crab. And then the edge of the Pleiron and whatever's outside it, ejector, etc. This boundary is at 2 parsecs in the case of the crab. And you can see that the velocity decreases and then matches to the observed expansion velocity of the filaments. The magnetic field piles up due to the pile-up effect that I described before. And here are the scalings for people that are interested, isobaric conditions and mass continuity imply r to the minus 2 for the velocity, and then MHD and steady state give you a linear increase in the toroidal magnetic field. This can also be used to explain the luminosity map of the Pleiron. Kennel and Coroniti have done that work some time ago in 1984. Okay, now a little note here, and I don't want to go into it in great detail, but you can see that in this inner part of the Pleiron, the gas pressure, which is just NKT, is going to be roughly constant because the N is roughly constant. But the magnetic pressure is increasing with distance, right? Because B, that goes as B squared, and B is increasing linearly with R. So you eventually get to a point where, even though you started out with the magnetic energy being low, you come into equipartition. That happens at about 1 parsec from the pulsar in the case of the crab, and then from then on, you can't compress the flow anymore, you can't slow down the flow anymore, so the VR remains constant, and then magnetic field falls away. There's a subtle question as to why the velocity here, which depends totally on what happens in the pulsar wind, how much magnetic energy you had, etc., etc., should be the same as the velocity of these outgoing filaments, which are also, that velocity is also determined by what's going on in the shell and the ejector. Those are apparently independent and causally disconnected things, and yet it turns out that they're equal. Why is that so? The most interesting part of the internal structure of the Pleiron is what happens at the boundaries, and of course I don't get to talk about that, but let me make an advertisement for the people who will talk about it later today. The outer boundary and the filaments at the outer boundary are the result of basically a huge cage of radial Rayleigh-Taylor fingers. That outgoing boundary is unstable to Rayleigh-Taylor, and you get these very nice fingers which produce filaments that you see. Jeff Hester will be discussing that later today. At the inner boundary, which is the termination shock of the pulsar wind, we have a whole bunch of wisps and knots and time-varying sharp like a low narrow angular resolution structure. Again, I won't discuss those. They will be discussed by, again, Jeff Hester later, and also Anatoly Spitkovsky. But I will say that a lot of this structure can be understood as the internal structure of the magnetized electron-positron ion shock that terminates the pulsar wind. And that has the important conclusion that there are probably ions in the pulsar wind, which is interesting. Okay, but that's not for me to talk about. Instead, I'll go on to the third part of the talk, which is concerned with how you use the Plerion as a calorimeter to probe the structure of the pulsar wind, which you can't see, basically, with some very tiny exceptions. The pulsar wind is invisible. Now, again, Anatoly will be talking about how you can use those WISP models to determine the number of particles, the flux of particles in the wind, and their Lorentz factor, etc. I instead want to concentrate on the question of energy transport in the wind. Energy transport in this wind is characterized by this ratio sigma of the pointing flux to the kinetic energy flux in the flow. So if it's magnetic dominated, sigma is big. If it's kinetic dominated, sigma is small. Sigma is important. It controls a lot of the properties of the Plerion as well as the wind itself. So the size, the shape, the ellipticity of the optical isotopes, the expansion velocity, we've already seen that. You want to match it to the 1500 kilometers per second at the edge of the nebula. Sigma better be small. Synchrotron spectral index generated at the termination shock of the wind, and also surface brightness. It turns out that sigma is at the center of a paradox in the case of the crab. At the termination shock of the pulsar wind, we've already shown sigma needs to be small, kinetic energy dominated, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to match to the filament expansion. I've already talked about that. However, near the pulsar, basically every theory of pulsar magnetospheres, I mean, such as they are, of course, but still, every theory of pulsar magnetospheres says that sigma is of order unity, or in fact much bigger than unity. And that is inconsistent with a standard steady state wind that says that sigma should be constant throughout the flow. We have these scalings here. So the question is, how do we explain that? Well, people have tried to explain this in many ways. The first is that sigma isn't small after all at the termination shock of the wind. I really didn't want to bring this up because it just seems like an appalling extra complication, but it may be true. Bagelman in 1998 suggested that a kink instability would destroy the nice ordered magnetic field in the wind, turn it into loops, and then somehow that would negate the argument for low sigma I gave you before. Arguments against this, for uniform spectral index, uniform polarization, hard to see how that would be possible in this geometry. Also, the fact that you have loops there doesn't mean anything. I would say that there is some argument about this question, but I would say that those loops still have a magnetic pressure, and magnetic pressure was at the core of the argument, which said that you wouldn't be able to slow down the flow. But if people want to question that later, they can. It's not clear which way it would go. Another possibility is that the wind itself converts from a high sigma flow to a low sigma flow. One possibility is magnetic nozzle. One finds, though, that it is usually too slow. You don't get the conversion happening quick enough. Another possibility is magnetic reconnection in the wind. But Lubarsky and Kirk recently showed that that reconnection will, of course, produce heating. Heating accelerates the wind, and again, that has the effect of not providing enough time for the sigma to be reduced to the degree that it must be reduced to explain the observations of the outer nebula. And the second thing here to remember is that any dissipative process like this is going to emit a lot of incoherent radiation of order the spin-down luminosity, and that is obviously not seen. Well, not obviously, but it is not seen. Okay, now in the time that remains, the 5 minutes that remain, I just want to mention an alternative idea, which is stuff that I've worked on with Don Melrose regarding what happens in this wind. We would argue that the wind is not a steady state flow. It is in fact a wave-like flow, intrinsically time dependent, and then there are reasons to think that that time dependent wave undergoes a dissipationless conversion from a high sigma mode to a low sigma mode, thereby alleviating the sigma paradox. How does that happen? Well, before I do my one slightly technical slide, I'll just give you the argument that the wind must be time dependent, and this is important. I don't mind if you don't listen to the next one, but please listen to this one. One can show that this wind is time dependent, intrinsically time dependent, by looking at the displacement current in the wind, evaluating its importance. Now, here's the wind looking from above, got a radial outflow, toroidal magnetic field structure. Displacement current is proportional to the electric field, that is like the magnetic field, which goes down as one on distance from the pulsar because the field has a toroidal geometry. The conduction current, which remember is the only other current in this problem, is bounded above by NEC. N is the number density of charges, C is the speed of light. That goes down as 1 on R squared in order to conserve particles in a constant velocity outflow. Clearly, this decreases faster than that. So there will be a critical radius beyond which the displacement current is greater than the conduction current. And that critical radius turns out to be 10 to the 5 light cylinder radii for the crab, and that is much, much less than the distance to the termination shock. So through the outermost 99.999% of this wind, the displacement current totally dominates the conduction current, and the wind is therefore intrinsically time-dependent. Now, what does this time-dependent wind look like? Well, since the displacement current is dominant, it obviously, and I put big inverted commas on that obviously, looks like an electromagnetic wave in vacuum. That's what it means for the displacement current to be dominant. I should say this isn't some kind of little, you know, ripple wave in the wind. It's a huge wave, large amplitude wave driven at 30 hertz by the rotating magnetic dipole of the pulsar, and global in the sense that it oscillates in phase at all points in space. It's not exactly vacuum because there is some plasma there, so the phase velocity of the wave is close to the speed of light, but in fact slightly greater than it. That says that the wave is superluminal. The wave is also relativistic in the sense that it accelerates electrons to high Lorentz factors in like one oscillation period of the wave. Now, you'll have to take my word for it that you can put together a quasi-self-consistent model of this wave and then look at how the wave evolves in a WKB kind of sense with distance from the pulsar. And the way you do that is just apply these averaged, phase-average conservation laws. You say that the particle flux in the wave, on average, goes down as 1 on R squared, and the total, pointing plus kinetic energy flux in the wave, also goes down as 1 over R squared. You don't want particles piling up. You also don't want a whole bunch of dissipation in the wind, which you don't see. This plot shows, when you do this model, the value of sigma at the termination shock as a function of the only two free parameters in the model, the electron-positron injection rate and the lines of these lines of constant Lorentz factor. And you can see that for all the typical values of these two parameters, sigma is small. It's less than 10 to the minus 2 or so. And in fact, for the state-of-the-art values that you get from Gallant and Ahrens and Spitkovsky's modeling of the WISPs, you turn out somewhere here, basically right on the crab value. So the important lesson from this picture is that if you have a wave, and if you have particle conservation and energy conservation on average in this sense, then the flow must energetically be kinetic energy dominated at the termination shock. 1 minute? Okay. So that's not the whole story, and this is where it gets slightly technical. Since I have 1 minute, I can avoid the technicalities. By just saying that the mode that I just described to you, the superluminal mode, has a problem. It doesn't work throughout the wind. It only propagates beyond that critical radius I talked about before. Then there's an obvious question, what happens inside the critical radius? Well, and the process here is some kind of analog of ionospheric reflection, like bouncing waves off the ionosphere. Inside, luckily for us, it turns out there is another mode, a subluminal mode. And this subluminal mode propagates everywhere. It has the properties shown here. It turns out that the subluminal mode is high sigma of order unity or greater. The superluminal mode is low sigma. This subluminal mode becomes unstable inside the termination shock and so you get a transition from a high sigma to a low sigma flow, okay, which is what we want. I cannot go into the details here. And so the implications for this model are then quite interesting for Pleirions generally, because that transition which I just described to you should emit radiation. It's complicated, it's unstable, it should be putting out radiation. And there is an inner knot discovered by Jeff Hester, I'm sure he'll talk about it later, at the appropriate point, but this inner knot is totally not bright enough, well, not as bright as you would expect given the dissipative nature of the upflow. Strong polarization, and then the possibility that clarions exist with this thing. I want to end by saying that this wave-like, I think it's very difficult to avoid the fact that the wind is wave-like, but we have seen, and again Jeff will describe it later, that there are very strong variations of the wind with latitude. In the Crab there is the polar jet, the equatorial torus, same sort of stuff in Vela. There is a big theoretical challenge to try and reconcile or marry the wave-like model of the wind with a description of how all these important wind quantities vary with latitude. Fortunately, like I said, it is important, but this is a very hard problem. Thanks.
I want to update you a bit on this layer of sort of soft gamma repeaters. To my knowledge, there are only two. One which existed for a few days and has since disappeared.
Oh.
Because of the one in SGR 1900. So it's just an afterglow of this burst. But the other one is around 1806 minus 20 on the vicinity. There was work by Karen Hurley showing that the position of the burst was not coincident with this strong radiation supposed at the center of this object. Tomorrow, Kaplan will show Chandra observation confirming this result. And in fact, that particular part of the Pleiron is, I think, associated with an LBV, which itself is interesting for lots of fun stuff, but not relevant. But the larger shell, I don't know. So you shouldn't spend too much time on the Pleiron.
So to summarize, you're basically saying that there is no Pleirion actually known around an SGR.
It's not the core.
Okay. It might be interesting to speculate why there isn't.
That's the more interesting.
Yeah. Yes?
Yeah. If you're doing your conversion from a high signal to a low signal, which is going, presumably that means that you would expect after that is going to take place, you would have zones of different signals.
Whether there are zones of different kinds of sigma once the instability has happened in the outer part of the pulsar wind, and if so, how large are those zones? I don't know whether there would be zones of different sigma. The pulsar is still rotating at the center. It is true that it's an instability, but the instability is kind of constrained to be somewhat regular in the sense that there is a pulsar in the center with a very strong magnetic dipole that is pumping out this huge wave. I would say, but I definitely don't know, that one possibility is that you won't get zones of different sigma, you will have to move to a different wave mode, namely the one which is stable and available. And if that is the case, then you would just have a different sigma, but it would be the same sigma everywhere. However, I'd be the first to say nobody knows how that, I don't know how that transition happens. If it happens in a mixed up, turbulent way, then what you say is correct, and off the top of my head, I can't give you an answer as to how large those zones would be. It is feasible, yes. I don't know what the partition of spin down energy between jet and equator is. It would be interesting, I don't know, but it would be interesting to calculate, say, the X-ray, the total X-ray flux in the direction of the jet and a total X-ray emission in the torus and see how those two compare. Now, I don't know, perhaps that's been done off the top of my head. I don't know what the answer is. But it's definitely feasible from a theoretical perspective. It's just not obvious to me which way it would go. The opposite is also feasible, but most of it comes out in the equator. So the question is, has sigma been measured in other supernova remnants? You can measure sigma. I didn't have time to describe it, but you can get a crude estimate of sigma by just taking the ratio of the shock radius, the termination shock of the pulsar wind, and the outer boundary of the pleurion. Okay, in the case of the crab, that's 0.1 parsecs and 20 and 2 parsecs. If you take that ratio and square it, you get an estimate, and invert it, you get an estimate of sigma. It's a very crude estimate, but you can still get it. So you can do that for a whole bunch of supernova remnants. I don't know whether it has been done. And it should be done, because it's absolutely critical. Actually, I should also say that from the point of view, in answer to that question, from the point of view of the wave-like wind model, there's nothing to say that this instability has to happen inside the termination shock. So you might get cases where the termination shock happens before the instability happens, and then you should have sigma big. And if you have sigma big, the pleurion would look totally different. It would look small, it would look circular, it would have a fast expansion velocity. Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah. It probably wouldn't. But that's interesting.
It unfolds the crab pulsar and the real pulsar. We see a kind of two rings or two arcs.
Yes.
A double structure. How can it be reconciled with this schematic?
I will defer that. The question was, how can the rings and arcs, the double rings, double arcs in Crab and Vela be reconciled with this wind picture? I will defer that question until Anatoly's talk. He has much better answers than I do. It may be a consequence, or it's possible that it's a consequence of the internal structure of the termination shock. There are ions in that shock, and there is evidence for that, and those ions go round, and therefore there are little loops, and you get... but Anatoly will talk all about that in detail later.
Vicky, you have a question. Phil, you better say...
Vicky, hello.
Well, I was going to ask a related question, but you didn't mention the effect of the pulsar flat motion, and I was going to ask you about the tractability of that problem, since you commented that the jet and torus is a very difficult problem.
Okay, so the question is, how tractable is the problem of the alignment of the pulsar proper motion and the axis of symmetry of the crab and Vela? The answer is, it's not very tractable. If you want to start from like a bottom-up theoretical perspective, you know, solve for the structure of the wind. Solving for the structure of that wind, especially in a wave-like flow, is really, really hard. It's an extremely important problem. I kind of can't emphasize how important it is in the context of this stuff, but it's hard, and to do it from bottom-up perspective, you would need that. Once you had that, it would be easy to calculate the rocket kind of effect that you would expect. But then the rocket effect, if it is due to some electromagnetic effect, which would be implicit in the question, then you also have the large uncertainty of, is the dipole in the star displaced? If it is, you will get a rocket effect, and then you don't know how much the dipole is displaced by. So there are other complications as well as the difficulty of solving for the wind.
Brian? One thing you talked about how for a Galchenyuk pulsar wind. Is there any thought on how energy transport in winds that are confined by the pulsar gravitational line?
there has been some, the question is how does energy transport work in winds which are confined by the pulsar is moving through the interstellar medium and there is a bow shock due to its motion through the interstellar medium. There has been some thought, but not much, and it's a very good point, because there you have a wide difference in possible pulsar velocities, and therefore a wide difference in possible locations of the shock relative to the pulsar. So, for example, in the wave-like wind type of picture, you might be able to test what happens when the shock is far away, what happens when it's close, and try and test the implications of the model that way. Not much work has been done on it. There's also an interesting question as to how the polar and equatorial partition would happen in that case, and what would you expect to see if for example, as Max was suggesting, there's a strong flux in the polar direction, then you might be able to work back from morphology of the bow shock to estimate things like the angles of inclination of the pulsar, etc. Not much has been done, unfortunately. So the question is, in the large amplitude wave picture, do the particles stay in the wave fronts or do they diffuse outwards? And if so, what effect would that have? In the case of this large amplitude wave, it turns out that the particles and the wave are one and the same thing. You can't separate them because the wave accelerates the particles, but then that makes currents which generate the field that makes the wave. So in that case where they're one and the same thing, at least in simple models, they're one and the same thing, and therefore there is no drift relative to the wave fronts. Everything is in phase as you move outwards. If you included scattering, I don't know how important scattering is in the wind. Usually people say that it is not, but if that was important, then the kind of effects you're talking about would might come into it.
Jeff, one more your time.
Actually, two questions. First, could you comment very briefly how the wave picture differs from the coordinated direction?
Yes.
Second, can you summarize what you consider to be strong evidence for the presence of ions?
OK, well, the second question was, what is the strong evidence for the presence of ions in the Crab pulsar wind? I will, again, avoid that one by deferring it until Anatoly's talk later. He's much more qualified to answer it than me. The first question was, what is the difference between the wave-like picture that I presented and the striped wind picture which was described by Coronetti. So I should just mention for those people who aren't aware, the striped wind picture is also a kind of a wave, except what you have is sectors of magnetic field of alternating sign as you go outwards in the wind, and in between those alternating signs of field you have little neutral sheets where the field is zero and where all the complicated dissipation and reconnection happens, which kills off the sigma in the flow. Now, that picture is similar in some ways because we also have striped fields, etc. But the crucial difference is that in Coronetti's wave, the magnetic field and the flow are all convected along together. Okay, so the stripes move outwards with exactly the flow velocity. Therefore, the phase velocity of the wave is basically the same as the outflow velocity of the wind. In this case, the phase velocity of the wave is different to the outflow velocity of the wind. They're both very, very close to the speed of light, so the difference is tiny. But it turns out the difference is very important, because once you have that mismatch, you can then, if you go into the rest frame of the wave, have unbalanced non-zero electric fields. Those electric fields make a lot of acceleration, and it is that effect which produces the low sigma in the superluminal wave case. In a superluminal wave, you can't cancel those electric fields, and so the particles are accelerated more, and that makes the balance more towards kinetic energy than magnetic energy. Okay, so the crucial difference is that in our case, the wave is moving through the flow, not with it, and that allows for the possibility of acceleration and low sigma.
One more question, Ben.
If I understand the question, you're the question is, there are two types of pleurions, the ones with a shell and the ones without. And in the case of, in trying to explain that difference, could it be that the reverse shock coming in hits the pleurion in one case and doesn't in the other? It's a good question. Whether you see the shell or the pleurion, or vice versa, or both, depends on the relative surface brightness of the two things. The relative surface brightness of the pleurion is basically set by the blob models that I described. Okay, magnetic field is decreasing, etc., etc. Except for the point that you make, that when the reverse shock comes back in, that pleurion can then brighten momentarily, so for a few thousand years, and so then maybe you would see it where otherwise you would not. So that's definitely possible. But other than that brightening, there isn't much effect on the surface brightness of the pleurion of that reverse shock coming in. Now, the shell evolution is, as I understand it, almost independent of the propagation of the reverse shock. The outer shell stalls and the reverse shock comes in, but the shock doesn't affect the outer shell. So in that case, the surface brightness of the shell is just determined by complicated things like how you amplify the magnetic field with turbulence and then what kind of Fermi acceleration you get, what kind of spectrum. So I would say that the propagation inwards of the reverse shock could only affect the question of whether you see the pleurion and shell or not through the fact that when it comes in and hits the pleurion brightens momentarily.
Okay, we'll move on.